Hello, come in.
Hello.
Come back over and get a sandwich.
Can we go to the man?
You can put a chair over here.
Yeah, I might need to invest in it.
Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So, you know that the readers are being sold in front of class. If you want a reader, go get one. My name is Eric Weiss. And this is a course on science in the transphysical worlds, so I hope you're in the right place. I wonder if maybe see, you way back there, I can't hardly see you. We can find a different way for you to, maybe you guys come to the circle somehow and then around here or something. We'll open it up a little bit. Begin, let me say what I understand by the phrase transphysical worlds. We all have some idea of what we mean by the physical world. As we'll see, there's a lot to be said about that idea. It's nowhere near as obvious as we think it is. But we do know that when we wake up in the morning, we find ourselves in this type of experience we call the physical world, or I prefer to call it the waking world. And the waking world is the world that is studied by science, and the world that has been the focus of attention for almost all philosophy for the last 400 or 500 years. But there are, I am going to teach this semester, there are other worlds other than the physical world or the waking world. And these are the worlds in which we find ourselves existing when we're dreaming, having lucid dreams, having out-of-body experiences, having sometimes on psychedelic experiences, and actually after death. This is the same world in which we live after the death of our physical bodies. And this world is what I call the transphysical world, or the transphysical worlds. And I believe there are several of them that are relevant to human experience. They're stratified in some sense. We'll be talking about all these details as the semester goes on. But the main point is this, is that in the modern world, we've had a collapse of the imagination. Now, the modern world is a much narrower and much more poverty-stricken world than the one that our ancestors lived in. And one of the ways we can track the collapse of the imagination is that it's expressed by the identification of the physical with the actual. And so when people say, well, is that real? What they usually mean is, could a physicist design an experiment in which that phenomena could be reliably and replicably measured? That's what it means for something to be real in the modern world, right? It means, can a scientist shake a stick at it in a particularly scientific way, right? And then it's assumed that those entities which are identified by scientific work, the atoms, the electromagnetic waves, the quarks, whatever they are, that those entities are the ultimate realities in the universe. Right? The idea is that the physicists are identifying the ultimate actualities in the universe, and that everything else is built up out of those, right? So a molecule is a collection of atoms, and a cell is a collection of molecules, and an organism is a collection of cells, right? And so everything is built up, as it were, from the bottom, right? From this reduced foundation of vacuous, simple things that scientists invent. Right? And I want to claim that that is absolutely false, that that is a wrong idea. Not partial, just wrong. Right? And that, in fact, the world that we live in already consists of a physical world and what I'm going to call an astral or a vital world and a mental world, and that these are actual worlds, actual places, by which I mean that these are places which have their own space, their own time, their own inhabitants, and their own laws. And our work in this class is going to be to try to articulate for ourselves the reality, the objectivity of these transphysical worlds. And now some of you may have come across these ideas if you study theosophy or many other traditions, but that's what I want to get clear. Right here at the very beginning, that's what we're up to. And I want to make sure that's interesting to those of you who want to take this class, right? It's like, are we on the same page here? Because the title of the class could be interpreted various ways. But this is what we're going to be about. Are we all on board with this idea? Okay.
Sure.
All right. Okay. Next, thank you so much for doing the printing.
Make one little announcement?
Yes, please.
First off, thank you all very, very much. I've left a couple of business cards on the table. If anybody did not get one, please call me, because I make these books basically to order or per class. Let me know and I'll have the book ready for you in 24 hours, and I'll meet you second floor lobby or fourth floor lobby. You won't even have to come to me unless you want to. If you do want to, I'm down on 8th Street, Folsom, right at 8. Thank you guys, have a good class.
Thank you.
Eric, could you repeat the idea again?
The idea is that the physical world is not the whole of the actual world, but that there are other worlds with other space-time structures, other types of matter, other types of laws that govern their evolution, and that those laws are radically relevant to our everyday waking experience.
To our physical world.
Yeah. Now let me make one distinction very clear. Often when people hear about subtle worlds, they think about archetypes, for example. I am not discussing archetypes. That's not what I mean by transphysical worlds. I do think, as I hope will become clear during the semester, that there are certain patterns that are ingredient in events. Right? So there are certain patterns that govern the flow of events. And it's very valid to describe them archetypally. There are those patterns. But that's not what I'm really talking about. I think that there are archetypes and real things on the physical world, in the astral world, and in the mental world. That goes all the way up and all the way down. But I'm talking not about some realm of subtle patterns. I'm talking about actual worlds of entities more or less like us interacting with each other in a real environment. An actual world, not just some theoretical place or some kind of collective unconscious, but an actual world. Okay? That's something I want to make really clear. Okay, so why don't we go around then and tell me your names. It's taking, I'm not great with names. We'll get them. And maybe what department you're in, and maybe like a sentence or two about why you're interested in the transphysical world, where you're coming from, what you're bringing to the conversation. All right? We have a lot of people. Let's not get too verbose. That's better.
So my name is Vladimir. I'm from PCC program. And as for this class, I signed in because it could help me in my master's thesis, which is about synchronicities.
Excellent.
So I will need any possible scientific exploration or proofs of so-called transphysical worlds.
Great. Thank you.
My name is Caleb. This is my last semester of master's PCC,
and I'm interested in trying to understand the heavenly realms through an Orthodox Christian perspective and bringing more legitimacy to that in a modern perspective.
I'm Laura, and I'm a first semester PCC student, and I'm interested in transphysical worlds, just, you know, to try to understand experiences through dreams and things like that.
I said dreams and stuff.
Right.
Your name is Laura. Yes. PCC.
Correct.
My name is Chris, and it's my first semester in PCC master's program.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I really don't have any background in transphysical worlds. I'm just kind of generally interested, I guess, as like an introduction to the program. Chris.
Master, PCC master's student, and I'm attracted to the course because I have experienced lucid dreaming, what I call second state experiences, and I've always been curious about what that and your death experiences have to say about the actual world.
Excellent.
My name's Heidi, and I'm in East-West Psychology. I'm working on my coursework for my PhD. And I kind of joke with Jorge that I'm EWP with a concentration in PCC. So I tend to take a course each semester. Last semester, I did an independent study with Brian, 20th Century Physics and East-West Psychology. So, yeah, I want to be in the class.
I'm Linda, second semester, master's at PCC, and I just feel like transphysical worlds are kind of lurking all around me, and like there's information that I need to get from them in order to continue on my life path, so hopefully this will help.
My name is Natalie, I'm a guest here. I'll be here sometimes and sometimes not. I think Eric is one of the most incredible channel for wisdom, for me, from my perspective. And I enjoy being in his presence and listening to the ideas. I'm here because I absolutely know that that's the truth for me, that there are other worlds and other space-time realities, and I'd like to learn how to integrate this world with those other worlds. So I'm an engineer and a businesswoman, and I'm also a psychic, so that's my work. I see people every day, and I get information about them that I would never have known before ever in my life. And I was like, how? What is that? Where's the physics here? So that's what I'm curious about, and I love the community at PCC. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm Rebecca, also a PCC student. I'm really interested in dreams and what other transphysical worlds there are. And especially creating a world that cultivates more imagination.
Excellent.
I'm Teresa. It's my last semester PCC, and just generally interested. Still kind of creating that last thesis for this last semester, and I'm pretty sure this will help me.
I'm Richard. I'm in PCC, and I'm really interested in actuality and what constitutes actuality and pushing beyond what we know. And so this class is going to help do that, I think.
Excellent.
My name is Mars, PCC. I am interested both in understanding better the scientific modern paradigm and how it constricts our worldview to possibly have us identify with just this realm of physical matter, and then being able to develop language that will help us talk about the more subtle transphysical worlds.
Thank you.
My name's Adam. I'm a PCC student, probably just checking in today, seeing how Eric's doing and class is doing. Good to see you all.
Hi, I'm Matt. I'm a second semester doctoral student in PCC. And what brings me to the class is both a deep respect for the scientific method, which I think can, in this context, be expanded to include experiences beyond waking consciousness or the physical world. And I guess I'm here to try to begin exercising, you know, what we could call higher organs of perception in order to perceive and consensually agree upon the structures of these wills. So, look forward to that.
I'm in my last semester of my master's in PCC, and I think in this moment I feel really present to wanting to explore the relationship between healing and transphysical world.
She stole my...
I don't know.
We're talking about this car.
My name's Matt, too, and I'm also very interested in the healing capacity or potential of beginning to experience transphysical roles, and I'm also interested in the capacity of each of us to begin to step into an awareness and experience a direct experience of that. And what would it be like for each of us to have that freedom and individuality of being in that space, and then enjoying a collective experience of that.
My name is Ghulam. I'm auditing at BCC. At my age, I think I couldn't find a better class than transphysical.
Ghulam, will you move a little closer to Matt so I can see?
Sure.
Thanks.
My name is Jennifer. I am in my second year of somatic psychology. I'm just auditing the class because I'm interested in it. I'm really interested in physics. I'm interested in dimensions of experience. I believe there's a lot more than meets the eye.
My name is Betsy. I'm in the PCC program. And after hearing some of your outline of what you're going to address in this class last semester and just sharing in your wisdom in general, I'm thrilled to be here. I think it's really important that this information get better substantiated in our culture to move things forward.
My name is Skylar. I'm a first semester BCC student. And I definitely resonate with a lot of what's been said already, and psychedelic experiences and meditation and experiences of real things, valid things that are less... that are difficult for me to put into words, and I'd love to be able to put them into words in a sort of systematic, scientific way.
Beautiful. So.
My name is Becky, and I'm second year PCC master's program. And I think I'm taking this class just to kind of prove to myself and my parents I'm not crazy. You know, so there really are things, other things going on that, you know, people have access to, and to ignore them doesn't really serve us. And pretend they don't exist, or that somebody's crazy because they believe certain things, doesn't really serve anything.
I'm Shannon, PCC, and I've been interested in dead experiences for a long time, and how I can interact with presenting. And somebody mentioned the integration of physical and
physical awareness and processes. Excellent. My name is Teswar. I'm in ACS. Taking this class to acquaint myself and reacquaint myself with other worlds.
My name is Azadeh.
What's your name?
Azadeh. I'm just visiting the school today.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Bill. That's my second semester of PCC, and my interests, I'm a scientist, a neuroscientist, particularly cognitive neuroscience. My degree is in biophysics, and also I've been doing spiritual work for about 12 years in the Diamond Heart School, if anybody knows that. And so, been working up a way to look at spiritual and scientific things myself, involving a lot of brain science and quantum theories of consciousness. And Eric's framework here for thinking about all these things just really expands where this can go, since I'm early in the process, and detail that comes in your work. Without the, let me expand on that.
Great. All right, that's great. Rich, are you going to be doing a discussion section?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, some of the things, first of all, some of us have been studying with Eric for a while. And there are some thinkers that he has worked with, you know, studied and stuff like that, that come up in the discussion in the various classes. So I'm going to be leading a study group an hour before class, actually at 10:30. I'm getting a room. I haven't gotten a room yet, but I'll send an email out to the whole class. So basically, starting next Thursday at 10:30, we'll be talking about Jean Gebser, Alfred North Whitehead, Sri Aurobindo, and things that come up in class. And really, like, some people did a study group last semester, and it was really helpful to everybody. And so anybody who wants to show up, I'll be there. You know, if you're not there, I'll take a nap. But, you know, people come. Because, you know, sometimes people can make it, sometimes they can't. But I would encourage, especially if you're, you know, just kind of starting out with the ideas that Eric is introducing in the class and want more background or want to just kind of talk about it, please feel free to show up. And basically, again, every Thursday at 10:30 until the end of the semester.
So I would like to come in on that. Richard did this last semester, and it was very useful. Everybody who went was really glad they did. And Richard is filling a need that I feel, and I hope you'll feel, because the material, the idea that I'm presenting, it's a whole worldview. It's a whole way of seeing reality. And I can't do it all at once, right? And so I've got this four-core sequence I'm working on right now, which sort of tries to wrap my arms around it, right? But some of you are here for the first time, and so some of you have been here for a while studying with me, and so I keep wanting to bring in ideas from these other thinkers that I've been teaching about also, right? And obviously some of you will be up on that and some of you won't. So the idea is that Rich will be here to sort of help you out to review the ideas of these other philosophers to see how they apply to what we're doing. And then also some of the ideas we're bringing up in this class are going to be challenging. So there'll be a chance for you to ask additional questions you might not have a chance to ask in class. And if you guys come up with some questions Richard can't answer, he can bring it right into class and you can work on it. So I really want to encourage you to take advantage of that, and, especially those of you who are newer to the program and don't have a lot of background in that. Also, I've asked Elizabeth and Matt to help out. Elizabeth and Matt are didactic geniuses. They spend a lot of time thinking about how to teach. And I very strongly invited them to make comments at any point in class about what's going on, if they have suggestions that might help the communication open up. And so they're sort of going to be here, both the students and the sort of informal consultants, to help out the class process whenever they feel inspired to do that. Or they may come in more actively in other ways if you think of it. Okay? So that's sort of some of the organisms of the class. All right. Wow. So, these ideas about the transphysical worlds, I was introduced to them when I was in my late teens. And I forget exactly how it happened, but somehow or other I got a hold of a theosophical text and started to, probably from some bookstore, you know. And so I started to read about these other worlds. And for some reason, and I can't tell you why this is, when I read about them, I knew that was true. It was like it spoke to something in me that was really just an emphasis, something I'd known from other lives, most probably, right? But I read it and just said, yes, right? And then I spent most of the rest of my life, like you, trying to figure out how to talk about it in ways that other people wouldn't think I was crazy, right? And it's been a huge struggle, right? Because to articulate these ideas in the modern world is just extremely difficult, right? Most of the data which supports these ideas is considered inadmissible by most scientists. They just simply refuse to look at the data. This is a remarkable thing you'll find in science. But I hang out with a lot of parapsychologists, and they're all just half crazy because they have all these results that nobody will even look at. There's a big controversy going on right now. Somebody published an article in some scientific journal about some precognitive studies they've done. And all scientific feel is in an uproar. You can't say that. Right? The evidence is inadmissible. Why? Because it's too inconvenient. Right? It makes us think. We don't want that. Right? So, anyway, so this is, and for me to actually be at the point that I'm 61 years old and I'm actually teaching a graduate level course in theosophical ideas, it's like a dream come true. Right? I never thought that would happen. I actually get to teach this at the university level. So, it's absolutely thrilling. Now, we have this problem. And everyone in this class seems to have some idea of what I mean by transphysical worlds. Many of us have out of body experiences, psychedelic experiences, and so forth. And the question is, how do we think about them? How do we make sense out of these worlds? Because we can't use the tools of physics to make sense of the transphysical worlds. So how are we going to do it? And this is a huge question. It's actually an enormously paradigm-busting question. Right? Because if you think, so, you know, there's paradigms, and then there's bigger paradigms, and there's even bigger paradigms, they sort of nest, right? And so there's a sort of huge scientific paradigm, which has to do with the idea that all the important data comes through the senses, and the only important data coming through the senses is the ones that we can measure, and by measuring what comes through our senses, we can now define everything important about reality. That's the scientific idea, right? And if you start with that idea, you follow me on that? Does that make sense what I'm saying? Right? Any questions about that? I really want to encourage you to ask questions of me. I have a tendency to start channeling. And when I start channeling, I tend to go a little bit over people's heads. And then people get sort of mesmerized by the channeling because it's kind of like glamorous, you know, and it's kind of like fun. I'm up here doing my thing, right? But then people get lost and don't know what I'm talking about. And that's completely counterproductive, right? So if you're not tracking me, I really want you to stop me and ask. And I guarantee you that there are no stupid questions. I guarantee, right? Because if you're confused about something, I'm positive you're not the only person. Number one, there's nothing you're confused about that somebody else won't find useful if you ask about it. And often the questions that seem stupid are the most important questions. Right now, as bright students coming up through the American educational system, you've all probably found that when you ask a philosophical question or a deep question, it's treated as a silly and irrelevant question because the teachers haven't got a clue how to answer it. Right? And so a lot of you have been traumatized by being smarter than your teachers for so long. And so, you know, the questions that you ask, well, what does that word actually mean? You know, I might use some word like consciousness or matter or science or something like that. And you might stop me and say, well, what does that word mean? And it might turn out we're all confused about it. Right? So just I really want you to recognize that your curiosity is the juice that will make this class come alive. So I really want to encourage you to be interactive with me, even if I get on a head of steam, you can stop me, okay? I don't want to stop myself because I have fun, right? But I want you to stop me if it's not working, okay? Okay. So, got this question. How do we talk about the transphysical worlds? As I'll mention to you many times during the semester, because it's a big experience for me, I'm part of the Esalen Center for Theory and Research, which is a special center put together by Mike Murphy, who founded Esalen. Now, what he does is he convenes conferences that meet every year for year after year to discuss certain central problems that nobody else is talking about. And so one of the groups that I'm, the main group that I'm a member of there, is a group that's studying reincarnation and life after death. And I was brought into that group because they needed some people to do some theorizing. They had amassed all the data. They had now proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, as far as they were concerned, that all these things are real. There's, you know, transphysical worlds and reincarnation and stuff. They got a whole book, 700-page book called Irreducible Mind, which will give you all the evidence you've ever wanted, right? But they don't know how to make sense out of it, right? And so they called me in because I had some ideas, and I started presenting my ideas. And I've been going back there for 5 or 6 years now, and basically I've gotten nowhere with these people because they're still trying to figure out how to explain these things using old scientific ideas. And they refuse to acknowledge that systematically, by the nature of the case, impossible. Right? The problem of explanation, in this case, is a metaphysical problem. We have to reconceptualize matter.
reconceptualize mind and reconceptualize time and space altogether if we're going to talk about the existence of transphysical worlds. And they simply refuse to do the work. They're not interested in having their imagination disrupted at that level. So the point I want to make is that in order for us to be able to take our experiences that are so powerful and valuable and to be able to express them in a language that actually communicates, we're going to have to do some deep philosophical thought. There is no way to make sense of the transphysical worlds given the basic epistemology and the basic ontology of modern science. You just can't do it, right? And so what I'm going to be trying to present to you is a new understanding of the whole actual world, right? This new understanding of space, time, consciousness, and causality, in terms of which we can understand both science and the transphysical worlds. So I'm trying to take I am taking a philosophical approach to this problem. I'm not starting with scientific ideas like quarks and stuff and trying to generate a theory of the transphysical worlds. And I'm not just talking about the transphysical worlds as if science was irrelevant. I'm rather trying to find, we have science over here, and we have the transphysical worlds over here. I'm looking for this. What's the framework within which we can make sense of both? That's the move I want to make. And it's a philosophical move. And so what I want to do today, because I didn't do enough last semester, is I want to talk to you about philosophy. Because what I discovered last semester was that many of you don't really know what philosophy is, and don't really know what the philosophical method is. And if you don't have some sense of that, then you won't really get it, what I'm trying to do. Right? So today's class is actually going to be about philosophical method. How do we think philosophically? Now, it's going to put up, the syllabus is both at the beginning of the reader and also part of today's notes. And today's lecture is going to put us one lecture behind for the rest of the semester, which we'll have to make up at some time. But I realized after last semester this is extremely important for me to discuss with you. And we're not going to communicate if we don't do this. So I want to talk to you about philosophical method. What does it mean to think philosophically? It's a particular way of thinking. And I want you to have some idea of how it works.
Eric, can I interrupt you for
yes,
a second?
Yes, you certainly can.
So you just set the premise that there's no way for the scientific method
For current scientific ideas, yeah.
So transphysical worlds cannot be explained effectively through the use of the scientific method, what you're trying to say.
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Basically, we'll discuss this in quite a bit of detail, but just to give you a little clue, we will be doing an analysis of the conditions under which measurement is possible.
Right.
All modern science depends on measurement. When we analyze the conditions under which measurement is possible, I want you to just think about this, right? Because this is something most people don't think about. Science is based on measurement. But what the hell is measurement? What actually do we mean by the word measurement? What are the operations that constitute measurement? It's much more mysterious than you think, and we'll talk about it, right? Measurement is not so obvious. But the main point is that modern hard sciences only function in the realm of the measurable. And in the transphysical worlds, the conditions permitting measurement do not obtain.
Measurement and observation.
Right, but the measurement part, you can observe in the transphysical worlds, but you can't measure.
You can observe?
Yeah, absolutely. With your transphysical senses, you dream, you're seeing the things around you. How do you see things in the dream?
Right, but when it's reported, then it's not observable to...
Well, my report, of course, if I have a dream reported to you, you can't see my dream in the normal run of things. I will argue that you can, in fact, see my dream under different circumstances. Right, so I'm going to argue for a whole different understanding of the objective and the subjective as well. Right? But the main point for this moment, in terms of why I say science doesn't work in its current form, I'm trying to expand science. But the reason, the basic paradigms of the hard sciences will not apply in the transphysical world because measurement is not possible there. You can't assign numbers to distances or weights or anything. Right? It's not measurable. It's objective and it's real, but it's not measurable. And this is one of the fundamental ideas I'll be trying to communicate to you, how a world can be objectively real without being measurable. And that's why I say the methods of modern science have to be radically revised in order to work in the trans system. Okay? Okay. Yeah?
I'm curious about like the precision of language when you make that jump, because when we think about objectively measurable, I think about the precision of language of being, you know, precise. It is this. And it seems that if you move into a place where it doesn't really hold those parameters, it calls into question the nature of language, and really, is it kind of a thought, or is it an expression of kind of an impulse or an imagination? I go to rhythm.
You're taking this way far. These are all very interesting things, but it's going to take us way afield. All right. Okay, so let me get into that. I was talking about measurement, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, how why science doesn't apply in the transphysical world. Language applies in the transphysical world, and it can be applied very precisely, but just not measurement. And stuff you're going into will take me too far away. Let's hold on that.
Okay. Could I just say, though, in like one sentence, that there's a difference between quality and quantity, and you can have qualitative language that's precise without necessarily having quantitative,
right.
And then I'll hold that thought to not take it.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up something that I'm ready to explore, but...
Yeah, no, I want to go somewhere else. We could go lots of places, but I have a specific place I want to go. And I want to talk to you about philosophical method. Right? And in order to talk about philosophical method, we have to talk about ideas. Because what philosophy does, in the simplest possible way, philosophy generates systematic bodies of ideas that explain experience. Right? That's very simple. We put together a philosophical system of ideas in order to explain experience. That's what philosophy is about, right? So now the question is, what is an idea? And I want to take a little bit of time with this, because if we don't have an idea of what an idea is, then doing philosophy is very confusing. So what is an idea? What is it? If I say red, or if I say star, or if I say square, what am I talking about? What are these entities which are designated by the words? What is an idea? Yeah.
Throw something out there, a category?
Okay, category. What's a category? See, I want to go deeper. A category is a type of idea. Well, what is an idea?
An abstract of an occasion.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. What do you mean? What is an abstract? What does that mean?
Well, an idea isn't something that's actual, but it's a non-actual reference to something
okay.
that is actual.
So an idea, when I say green or something like that, I'm designating something non-actual. I can buy that. Green is not something in the sense that this is something, right? It has a whole different sense of existing than something which, like things are in time and space. Things are involved in causal relations with each other, but ideas aren't. Right? What is it? What is an idea? Isn't it amazing? Here we are, graduate students, right?
Are they not involved in relations with each other?
What?
Why are ideas not involved?
They are. Well, I say they weren't involved. I make not causal relations in the same way, for example, that if I go like this, right, I'm having a causal impact on the paper, but I can't have a causal impact on an idea with my hands. Right? In other words, a thing is part of the actual world. It's involved in causal relations in time and space. But an idea, greenness, where is it? Right? Is it anywhere? Is it everywhere? What is an idea? It's a Plato's question, right? We're talking about the forms, right? This is the whole essence of Western philosophy. Western philosophy begins with the articulation of the distinction between form and matter. This is the whole beginning of Western philosophy, right? We have matter, the stuff, substance, the things in the world around us, and then we have ideas.
Are ideas real?
Yes, they are, I would say so, but not actual. Ideas are real, but not actual.
So are ideas the possibilities that we can then choose to make actual?
That's it. Right? An idea is a possibility. I really want you to feel this. All your life you've been working with ideas, and you haven't asked what they are. An idea is a possibility. Right? It's a possible character that events can have. So green, right? Green is a possibility. The possibility of greenness was realized in Heidi's shirt, right? The possibility of greenness is being realized in my mind, in my consciousness, and the possibility of greenness shows me what's possible in the future, because I could make a green thing, right? And so ideas are possibilities. They're real possibilities. And thinking about ideas matters, because the way we think about ideas conditions what is possible for us. Right? Our ideas about the world tell us what is possible for us. Right? I think I'm a professor, right? So I can go up to the adjunct faculty drawer and open it. Nobody will yell at me, right? It's a possibility that opens up from my being a professor, right? Because you aren't a professor, you can't open that drawer without somebody yelling at you. Your possibilities are different than mine. You see? Right? So ideas are possibilities, and our existing in the world, moment to moment, is a process of seeing what's possible and deciding what to make actual. Right? So working with ideas is working with actual possibilities. It's a way of working with reality. Right? Thinking has causal consequences in the unfolding of the cosmos. It's causally effective. And it's the way we work with possibilities to elaborate ranges of possibilities among which we can choose as we move into the next moment. So now, we can spend a whole semester on this, right? But I just really urge you to take some time during the week to contemplate this. And you know, as you're sitting in your bathtub and the ideas are going through your head, you know, and stop and think, oh, every one of those ideas is a possibility. One that was either realized in the past, or is being realized, or may be realized. Every idea is an actual possibility that's relevant to the world around us. So thinking is not some shadowy representation that happens in some internal theater that nobody else can see. Thinking is the way that we work with the past to find out what's possible in the future. Thinking is embedded in the actualizing process that makes this a cosmogenesis. Okay? Yeah?
I have a question about that, because the way you just stated it, it seemed to me that you were saying that any idea you have either happened in the past, is happening now, or may happen.
Yeah.
And I want to make a distinction. You have great examples that you give about, like, you know, it's not possible that you, like, could wind up in Washington, D.C. in 2 seconds right now. Some, you know, those kinds of examples you give.
Right.
But what if I have an idea that you could? Is it possible or not? Or how, you know, could you break that down a little bit?
You already did. You just made this much more subtle. You're absolutely right. We can elaborate ideas that cannot be realized. That's very interesting, working with possible worlds. So I just was speaking in an unguarded way.
And, okay.
And you're qualifying it in a wonderful way.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading in Kassir the other day, he's talking about how the enormous importance of the human capacity to think in terms of possible worlds. He says, that's something animals can't do. They may be able to function in this world way better than we can in a lot of ways, but they don't construct possible worlds. They don't construct utopias. Right? So this ability to work with the impossible is very important. And I overstated when I neglected to say that.
But Eric, I don't think we do think of ideas that aren't possible. They may not be possible, but somehow in our thinking, we abstract out of things less information. And when you say, "Oh, I could be in Washington in 2 seconds," you just don't really think what that means. There's something about, in other words, the ideas that go in your head about being in Washington in 2 seconds is very different than the reality of it. So I don't think we think I don't think we ever have thoughts that aren't possible in our thinking, even though they might not be possible in this actuality that we're in.
Well, you know, there's a lot of subtleties here, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on them today.
Okay.
But, you know, there's the actual world. There are the possibilities that open up from the actual world. Those are real possibilities. Then there are other possibilities that we can imagine that don't seem as if we could realize them in this world. And there's all these different layers, and it's very complicated. And we could spend a whole 2 or 3 classes discussing all those different levels. I don't want to do that right now. I want to go somewhere else. I want to stay on subject. So, ideas. We now have some idea of what an idea is. An idea is a possibility. And there are two kinds of ideas that I want to bring out. And there are lots of ways to divide up ideas, but there's a division I want to make between those ideas which describe simple characteristics of things, like green. I have to be more specific. Let's say I have a word that designates a very specific shade of green. Let's say chartreuse, but I mean by it some very particular chartreuse, right? The chartreuse that I saw at 7 o'clock this morning when I was looking at my bathroom tile. That's the one I mean, right? Okay, so I got so busy on that I forgot where I was going.
Different kinds of ideas.
Yeah, so that's an idea. It's a very simple idea, like that particular shade of chartreuse. You either see it or you don't. You either know what I mean or I don't, and I can't explain it. And there are a lot of ideas like that. Simple ideas, simple characters that things have. That's one type. And the other type of idea is a relational idea. So take the word square. The concept square. It does not refer to any particular shape, it refers to a relationship among points. Right? A square is a relationship among points. It's not anything, it's a relationship. A mathematical equation describes a relationship, but it's not a thing. Right? So it's a complex idea. So there are simple ideas like green and red, and complex ideas like square and relativity theory, which are all about relationships among things. Right? So there's simple ideas and relational ideas. Okay? Now, as philosophers, here's what we do. We try to come up with a system of ideas that is adequate to the analysis of our experience. A system of ideas that is adequate to the explanation of our experience. That makes sense what I mean by that. So I just want to take a minute with that. So let's look at this word adequacy. Right, so let's say, for example, I'm interested in analyzing the movements of macroscopic bodies in the world, right? Cannonballs, ping pong balls, balls going down inclined planes, things like that. I want to see how they work, right? So after several hundred years of intensive work, people found out a really good set of ideas that enables them to really perfectly analyze the movements of these macroscopic bodies. And that set of abstractions is called Newtonian mechanics. Okay? So, you know, three-dimensional box, uniformly flowing time, little point masses running around bouncing off each other, that's the Newtonian universe. And given that, you can analyze all the movements of the solar system, you can analyze the movements of the tides, blah, 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 right? A lot of good stuff comes out of that. So you have a set of abstractions that's adequate to the description of macroscopic motion of inorganic bodies. Right? Now here's the mistake that scientists made. They decided that set of abstractions should be adequate for everything.
Right? So now they want to explain consciousness in terms of point masses bouncing around in a three-dimensional space. History, biology, they want to explain all of it in terms of a bunch of point masses bouncing around in a three-dimensional box. It should be obvious to anybody with half a brain that you can't do it because the explanation is too abstract. In other words, you take a big box and put a lot of point masses in it and let them bounce around forever. Why will it ever become conscious? Why will it ever become alive? There's nothing in the equations that would predict that. It's a toy universe that's too poverty-stricken to actually account for experience. Right? So we need a broader set of ideas if we're going to account for experience. The ideas of science are designed to account for the behavior of our experience insofar as it moves through our physical senses and through an experimental apparatus. That's all it tells us. All science tells us is about how scientific apparatus interact with scientific apparatus. That's basically what science tells us. It doesn't tell us about consciousness, about meaning, about life, about purpose, anything. It's just too abstract. Right? So we're looking for a set of abstractions that's adequate to the experience we're discussing. Follow what I'm saying there? Okay. So in philosophy, this is the whole thing. It's experience and ideas and systems of ideas. That's what we're dealing with. Yeah?
I'm curious. I think you have an answer to it, but when I think about having a system of ideas that's adequate to the explanation of my experience, I wonder if that becomes a closed circuit, whether everything that within exists within the system, whether there's ever something that's out, like is there an open circuit philosophy that allows for possibilities that haven't been experienced.
Right? It's just like science, right? We have an idea. We start with experience. We start with some body of experience. And from it, we abstract ideas. Now, what does that mean? So, let's say I'm talking about the experience of living in community. I want to do some philosophy about that, right? Well, I've got to start with some kind of ideas. So, let's say one of my ideas is going to be persons. I'm going to assume that every society is an interaction of persons. And then I'm going to decide that there are various different relationships that happen among persons. And I could list them. There's empathic interactions and structured interactions and bureaucratic interactions. I don't know, I'm thinking this up, right? Now I have persons and interactions among persons. I'm going to try to use that to construct a model of my social experience. Right? So now I have some kind of model. The model says there's person one, person two, and so forth. And there's relationship one and relationship two and so forth among these people, right? So now I want to come up with some combination of these things that will explain my experience. But it'll never work. You see, because no set of ideas is ever adequate to any situation. So we start with a situation, we generate a set of abstractions, we use those abstractions to try to generate the experience again, and then we see, was that illuminating? Was that interesting? What did it account for? What did it fail to account for? And then we go back and come up with some new ideas. So it's an open loop, just like science. It's constantly an open loop. Right? So a philosophical project starts with some domain of experience, something you want to explain, abstracts a set of ideas that are either simple ideas or complex ideas, uses those ideas to generate an accounting of the experience, and then it tests to see how good that is, and then it goes back and revises the ideas. That's the basic philosophical loop. It's the same as the basic scientific loop. Right? It's just that it doesn't involve measurement, and it doesn't involve the same kind of testing. It involves a testing that's more rich in terms of aesthetically rich, morally rich, cognitively rich, than the kind of testing we do in science, which is very abstract by comparison.
Which came first? Experience?
Yeah. Experience comes first. Philosophy always happens in the middle. You know, philosophers always have this pretense about starting at the beginning, but they never do. Every philosophical project starts in a linguistic community. right? It's a bunch of people who are speaking to each other in some language who want to ask questions about themselves, and that's where philosophers come in. So philosophy always begins with all the presuppositions built into language, all the cultural presuppositions all the philosophers bring with them, right? And then it gets tested against experience and so forth, right? So we always start in the middle of given ideas. We're always trying to refine ideas. Okay, with me so far? Yeah.
I have a question. I'm with you on the critique of sensationism in science and all of that, but I've been thinking about how you characterize the modern worldview, and it seems that you're assuming that there's too much of a scientific sort of atheistic materialistic reductionism than I see in the modern worldview.
Well, then, before you go on further, what do you mean? What period do you mean by modern?
I mean, let's say today. Let's say contemporary instead of modern.
Well, that's very different, because when I say modern, I don't mean contemporary. And when I say modern, I mean the period between, let's say, 1600 and the end of the 19th century.
Okay. Well, still, it seems like what you call transphysical worlds is the common idea amongst most people.
Except in the last few hundred years.
No, today. I would argue that today that most people are religious. Most people, especially in America, are skeptical of science and evolution. Most people would not elect an atheist for president. And most people do not believe that their spiritual beliefs can be reduced to science.
Okay.
People believe in prayer. The New Age section in the bookstore is way bigger than science and biology. So it seems like maybe a better way to frame it would be that there's not a rigorous philosophical attempt to interpret this perspective, but that the perspective is quite pervasive.
Well, the point that I'm making has to do with modern thought so far, right? Which really is not has nothing to do with sociology or what people believe or anything else. Right? So I'm talking about sort of mainstream academic thought is what I'm talking about. Now, it is the case that we are in the midst of the mutation of consciousness. And as I will suggest at some point or other, I believe that a mutation of consciousness involves not just a shift in ideas, but also a reorganization of the senses. You see, at each different historical epoch, we operate in a certain characteristic mode of organizing our sensations. So a lot of people, for example, Schlein and some others, have made the point that in the mental mutation, which began with the Greeks, the visual sense is very highly privileged. Like the visual sense really dominates all modern philosophy. Almost all the examples come from vision. And in fact, logic, going all the way back to Aristotle, is basically something that we can abstract from the experience of the visual field. In the visual field, we have distinct regions of color, which contain distinct regions of color in this nice hierarchical way, just like logic. And it's the only sense modality in our whole being that reflects logical relations, is the vision. Right? So all of the modern world is based on this very high privileging of the visual sense. Right, the idea is that we get privileged access to reality through our vision. That's the modern experience. Right? If you go back into mythic times, you go before the Greeks, vision was not that important. Audition, hearing and speaking, was much, much more important. And people didn't pay that much attention to their vision. Right? And so there was a whole, around that point, 2,500 years ago, the way we organized our senses shifted. Right? So we can see that our sensory organization is variable. What I want to suggest is that the number of senses we have is vast. I read one book the other day that suggests we have 50 physical senses. I mean, balance, for example, is, I realize a whole other sense, the whole other sense organ. No other sense organ tells us if we're upright or not. It's a unique sense organ. We have way more than five senses here, right? But we also have what I call transphysical senses. Right? So when you're dreaming and you see other entities in the dream world, you're using your transphysical eyes. Right? And we have all kinds of transphysical senses. And in the entire modern world, we've been taught to ignore the data from the transphysical senses. That's just imagination. That's purely private. You can ignore that. It's crazy if you even think you're seeing it, right? But we're now shifting into a world where those transphysical senses are becoming more and more insistent. People are having more and more psychic experiences, more and more out-of-body experiences. Right? These things are beginning to press themselves on us, which is requiring us to reorganize our whole sensory suite. Yeah.
Would you say that even in Newton's science, for example, that there's that Newton was participating in the transphysical world in order to make sense of the mathematical relationships between physical objects?
No. I don't want to go there. And this is important, right? Because in the waking world, there are experiences. And from those experiences, we abstract ideas. And some of those ideas are mathematical ideas. Right? So these mathematical patterns are ingredient in the behavior of the physical world. And we abstract them out through our physical senses. We don't need anything transphysical for that. Right? So mathematical ideas are not transphysical. Right? The transphysical worlds are actual worlds in which mathematical ideas are relevant, just like they are in the waking world. But it's a world, not some realm of patterns. And it's a world in which there are entities that are causally interacting with each other in some sort of framework of space and time. A world. Yeah.
You said it has matter.
Wait a minute.
So how does that relate to intuition, though? For example, you know, like you can get this intuitive leap that maybe what Matt is referring to for Newton. Where is that coming from?
Well, you know, the word intuition is way, way, way too vague.
Okay.
Right? And we have to be much more specific. Right? What are you actually meaning there? Right. So, for example, we don't need intuition at all in this case, let's say from Newton. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at it, right? But Newton looked at the results of his predecessors. He looked at the results of his experiments. And he abstracted out certain ideas like gravitation or point mass. And then certain relations among them, which were mathematical. Now, how does he learn the mathematics? You know, we could say he's reading the mind of God, or well, lots of things, right? Whitehead would say that, right? But it doesn't involve intuition, it involves conceptual apprehension, in Whitehead's language. It involves seeing the relations among ideas. Is that what you mean by intuition?
So, yeah, you know, I'll have to
make
it more precise.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to do that at the moment. I know that I snatch things that seem to come from nowhere.
That's right.
That now it's seem to how come from what you would call a transphysical world, but they may relate to things that are very much of the physical world.
Right. So that hopefully by the end of the semester we'll have better language for making making these fine discriminations.
Okay.
Eric, do you include dreams in that?
In what?
The worlds that you're talking about.
Yeah, dreams are. I would say dreams are experiences in transphysical worlds. Memories of experiences of the transphysical world. That's what dreams are.
Okay, so I know you also have no psychological terrain, so you don't think that there's any kind of cognitive residue and just the working out of...
I think that there obviously is some of that, right? But it's you know, the interpretation of everyday nightly dreams becomes quite complex.
Right.
And certainly I do not deny that dreams are meaningful. But of course everything in all worlds is meaningful. And when we get into it and look at the conditions of perception in the transphysical world and the astral world in particular, we'll start to get a whole different understanding of how dreams work. But I don't want to go there right now. That's gotta develop the tools for it, okay? What I want to talk to you about is philosophical projects. Now, a lot of you like to think, you wouldn't be here. And a lot of you have various styles of thinking. So I was talking to a woman at a party the other night who said, you know, like whenever she hears something, she takes it in and she wants to bring it into her body. And she wants to see how it connects to everything else. Right, so a lot of people are probably sympathetic to that idea, right? We should bring this to our body, we should see how they connect, and we should get the feeling resonance and everything. But when we're doing philosophy, we actually don't necessarily want to do that. Right, philosophy actually involves a certain amount of disembodied activity. And if we're going to be philosophers, we have to recognize that we don't only just live in our bodies and our emotions immediately, but we also have the capacity to step back and to hang out in a realm of abstractions and to work in that realm. Right? And that's really valuable. Right? So, you know, for example, if you're doing Newtonian physics and you want to... I'm talking about Newtonian physics, and I'm talking about different kinds of models, and I've totally lost what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about philosophical projects, right? Philosophical projects play ideas against experiences. So we're talking about, flights of fantasy, flights of disembodied fantasy. Okay, so we have this cannon. Now we're going to shoot a cannonball, right? And we want to know how far it's going to go. Okay, so we look at this and we say, okay, well, the cannon is at the angle of 36 degrees, and the ball weighs 37 pounds, and we have a charge of 2 pounds of gunpowder. Right? Now we have these numbers. We plug the numbers into the equation. Once we get these numbers, we forget about the cannon. The cannon's now gone from our consciousness. Now we just have these three numbers, the degrees, the weight of the ball, and the amount of gunpowder, and some conversion factor that gives us how much power you get from that much stuff, right? And so now, forget the cannonball. I've got these three numbers. I plug these numbers into an equation. I don't know exactly what the equation looks like. And on the other end comes this other number, which tells me how many feet the cannonball is going to go, right? Here's what I want to point out. I start with an actual cannonball. I abstract out some characteristics, right, some ideas. I then have an equation which describes the relationship among these ideas. I take these ideas, I run them through the equation, I get another number. None of this has anything to do with cannons at all, right? Now I take this number and I bring it back over into the real world. Right? So when I went from the cannonball to these ideas, I was dealing with the real world. When I went from this number back to the real world, I'm dealing with the real world. But in between, all of this is a pure flight of fantasy. Right? It's a pure intellectual excursion. I got the numbers from the real world. Now I go off into the world of mathematics and play with the numbers until I get another number. And then I bring it back to the actual world. In between, these numbers could mean anything. In between, the numbers lose all reference to anything but themselves and become just numbers. Right? And so, in order to do physics, we want to be practical, right? But half the time or more, we're dealing totally in our heads. Being in your head is a good thing sometimes if you want to be a philosopher. Right? You have to appreciate the value of abstract thought if you want to be a philosopher. If you want to take every single idea and bring it into your body and feel the full emotional impact of it, you will never be a philosopher. You'll be something else, something interesting, but not a philosopher. So I'm trying to communicate to you that philosophical thinking is a very special kind of thing. Right? It's different than some of the other kind of thinking you do. So, in a full philosophical project, we start with some domain of experience. And from it, we abstract simple ideas and complex ideas. Right? Simple ideas like green, red, and complex ideas like square and various equations and space and time, which are very complex ideas of relationship, right? So whatever our domain of experience is, we get some ideas about it, And then we synthesize these ideas into a system of ideas. So a system of ideas, for example, is like a philosophical system. Like process in reality is a philosophical system, right? Or I think of pure reason. These are like books that articulate whole systems of ideas. Right? Now, obviously, we're going to test these ideas against experience so as to be able to generate better ideas. It's an ongoing process. But along the way, there are a lot of other things that we do. So, for example, if we have a system of ideas, one of the things we do as philosophers is we compare them to other systems of ideas, right? Right. So we could write whole philosophical papers comparing Kant's scheme to Whitehead's scheme. That's way abstract, right? But it's valuable for philosophers, right? The other thing that's really interesting to do is to take a system of ideas and to ask, what are its presuppositions? What has to be true for this body of ideas to work? So, for example, let's say we started with Newtonian mechanics and said, what must be true about reality if Newtonian mechanics is going to work? So we might say, okay, Newton's mechanics only works if all the important features of reality can be measured. Right? And we can ask, is that true or not? Right? See what I'm saying? We can, if we look at the presuppositions, we can often get very interesting things. Now, last thing I want to say is something about on this topic, is something about this particular line here. How do we get from a system of ideas back to experience? Right? So let's say I've been studying Whitehead, and I now think I can analyze experience in terms of concrescence and prehensions and all those crazy ideas, okay? How do I then come back to experience to see if it works? How do I generate a description of experience starting with a body of ideas? See the question? Right? It's a question of deduction. And we can't do it unless we're logical. If our ideas aren't logical, then we have no way of testing them against reality. Because we can't generate an explanation with them. You see what I'm saying? So there's two different ways in which we generate explanations. And one is the old Aristotelian way. And the old Aristotelian way, we start with a category, and we deduce things about different entities from the categories to which they belong. Okay, so we think of a category like man. It's a category of entities, according to Aristotle. Let's say humans, not better. Humankind, right? And humans have the property, all humans, by definition, have the property of being mortal. So now, if I know that Socrates is a man, a human, by virtue of being human, I know that Socrates is mortal. This is the kind of knowledge we get from the old sort of deduction. And there are whole philosophy texts in the old days that would try to just deduce everything from a set of categories. The new logic is much more dynamic, and it's the kind of logic that we see in computer programs. In the new logic, instead of having just categories, we have entities. And we have processes. Right, so let's say in a computer program, I might have variables, you know, A, B, and C. These are variables, B and C. And then I'll have a function which says C equals A plus B or something. That's a function, right? I have entities and then functions of entities. Follow me on that? And so the idea is that we try to generate an explanation by, in effect, writing a computer program that will generate the experience. Right? See what I'm saying? So, you know, Whitehead might say there's causal experiences and conceptual experiences, and they get, by certain rules of combination, they get put together into more complex entities. And if you keep running that process over and over again with the various causal perceptions and the various conceptual perceptions, eventually you can construct the whole picture of reality that each person has in each moment. Sort of by running this program, which Whitehead calls concrescence, you can end up generating experience. And so instead of just trying to deduce it, you try to generate it like by running a computer program in effect, right? So it's a more dynamic form of logic. But the point is that both of these forms of logic have to be clear. It means all the terms have to keep the same meaning throughout the argument. It means things have to be systematic and so forth. Otherwise, you can't actually engage this testing loop unless this part of the loop is quite logical. Okay? You want to follow me on this? I'm trying to talk about doing philosophy. So this is the basic idea. Right? Philosophy is abstracting ideas out of experiences, assembling the ideas, one second, assembling the ideas into systems, testing the systems of ideas against the experiences. That's what it is. Yeah?
I kind of get what you're saying in an abstract way about the testing in two different ways, but can you give an example of that?
Yeah, let's see. So, I should have thought about this more, but... I don't have a great example.
Well, your cannon example, you just didn't you go and you measure the cannon ball and see if it went as far as you thought it would go, and
let me put it this way. Aristotelian logic could not permit us to analyze the flight of the cannonball. Period. Why not? Because Aristotelian logic is simply a logic of the relationships among categories. That's it. That's all Aristotelian logic gives us. When mathematicians looked to logic to find a support for mathematics back in the 1900s, they found out that Aristotelian logic didn't help them one bit because you couldn't even express the relationship greater than or less than in Aristotelian logic. All it does is tell you about categories. So they invented a whole new logic. And this logic is functional logic. It's dynamic logic. It lets us say how things transform into other things. Instead of just telling us what the categories are, it lets us analyze processes of transformation in a logical way. Does that help?
Yeah, so it's basically the way that we think now.
Scientifically, yeah. Okay. That's right. All science is based on the new logic. Absolutely. Yeah?
Can you say something about induction?
What do you mean?
So there's deduction where you reduce
right. Yes.
Categories.
So this link here, that's the inductive link. The inductive link is a question of how do we pull out of experience relevant ideas in terms of which it could be explained.
Oh, okay.
Right? Now, induction is often presented as the question of how do you generalize from a bunch of examples. It turns out that's a very inadequate way of analyzing induction. But induction really comes down to how do we abstract ideas from situations. And it's discussed very extensively. If you want to learn more about this, I very strongly recommend the first chapter of Kassirer's book, Substance and Function, in which he discusses this new logic in a very lucid way.
And what was that one sentence definition of induction again? About
induction is the process through which we abstract ideas from situations.
Would that be the simple ideas then?
And the complex ideas both. They're all abstracted from the situation.
But deduction seems to work upon more complex ideas, working with complex ideas and how they might relate to and function.
Well, exactly. I'm saying that induction involves both.
Right.
The complex ideas and the simple ideas. They're both inducted from experience.
Right.
Then by deduction, we apply them back to experience.
Right, okay, yeah.
Okay. So let's see, it's 1:05. So I want to take a break and come back at 20:20. Please be punctual coming back from break. It means something to me. Okay? By the way, we're 1 week behind now on the syllabus. And so next week, what I want you to read is the stuff on Gebser in The Reader. There are two essays on Gebser. Now, the reason I'm asking you to read that is because
I know myself well enough to know that I'm not going to be able to discuss the transphysical world without discussing Gibson, because you just need him to make sense out of what we're talking about. And so I want everybody to have some familiarity with his ideas. And so I assigned two articles that describe his ideas. Neither one of them is perfect. You're not going to get everything. There's a lot of weird terminology in there. Read them. Get the basic idea. Because I need you to have some idea what that's about so we can just discuss it in class. Okay? And that'll do the reading for the next time. And the next time I want to just really talk more about the transphysical worlds as we find them in our experience. Okay. What I want to talk about now is how this understanding of the philosophical project is going to affect the requirements for the course. Because I've realized that I don't just want to teach you philosophical ideas. I want to teach you how to philosophize. Because philosophical ideas aren't any good if you don't know what to do with them. And so I'm going to be asking you to write your papers in a philosophical way. Right? Which means that I'm going to expect the paper to be logical. Right? And I want to tell you just what that's about, how you do it, and why it's important, and how we're going to actually work the mechanics of it. I'm open to feedback on this. This is an experiment. But after last semester, when I got the papers, I felt so bad that I hadn't done this with the last class, right? Because so many of the papers just missed the point about how to write a philosophy paper. And it's a skill you need to have if you're going to graduate from BCC with a master's degree. You need to have some idea how it's done. Okay? So, the first thing I want to talk about is grammar. And I want to tell you that it's extremely important to me that your papers are grammatically coherent. And I shouldn't have to say this, but the fact is that about half to two-thirds of the papers I get have terrible grammar. And that is just not acceptable, right? And by the way, if you're having troubles with grammar, there's a lot of resources available at the school, various kinds of tutoring you can get to help you learn how to write. But I want to tell you why it's important. Why is grammar important? Why am I insisting on it? And it's become sort of popular to think, oh, grammar is just those old silly rules. We don't need that, right? But it's really important. And the reason it's important is because it lets people understand what you're saying. So the most common grammatical error I see is a failure to achieve agreement, what I call agreement. Now, grammatically, there are three or four different types of agreement. And we can look at them here on the sheet, right, on page 2 of your notes. There are these four agreements. Right, so one of them is grammatical person. I am versus he is. Right. So the point is that whenever we use a certain kind of preposition, like a first person or a third person preposition, the verb form changes to go with that preposition. Right. So I am, he is. You get the idea. Right. That's one kind of agreement. Another kind of agreement is number. Right, so we have one car versus two cars. Right, now you'd think this is trivial, but often in sentences people write they'll, at one point they'll make a singular reference, then they'll use a plural pronoun, or vice versa. And this kind of stuff really is distracting to anybody who's trying to read your stuff carefully. These kinds of agreement are really important. Also, I am versus we are. Right, getting the preposition and the verb form lined up. Also, gender. You want to keep his and hers straight, right? If you're talking about a male at one point in the sentence, you can't shift to a female pronoun later in the sentence and refer to the same person, right? Now, there's a particular issue about this that's puzzling to me. You guys might have an answer for me. I've noticed that people are having trouble with the pronouns his and her, in particular, when we're referring to a neutral party, like especially one. Right? Do we say his or her? Now, in the old days, it was easy. Everything was the male pronoun, and so there was no real issue. But now, that's embarrassing. We can't do that anymore. What are we supposed to do?
Right? So a lot of people, instead of using his or her, will say their, which is a plural form. Now, I'm not sure what to say about that. Is that the way the language is evolving? Is that how we're trying to solve that problem? Yeah.
That was always an option, and if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, they'll talk about the history of the use of their.
And it can be used singular.
Yeah.
Okay, that solves that problem. Thank you very much.
Actually, that doesn't solve the problem, because dictionaries are based off of descriptive language, what people are using, not prescriptive, which is correct. So I think there's still up in the air about which is proper and which isn't, because dictionaries just...
But the point is, it's becoming, I think this is becoming revived in the English language.
A descriptive instead of...
That it seems that the pronoun there can be used for singular situations if you want to avoid his or her. It always creeps me out, but apparently it's becoming accepted usage, and I don't know of another way. What I like to do is use H-I-R, which goes both ways, right? But nobody else does that but me. So anyway, that's the one thing about agreement that I'm confused about. And then there's the grammatical case. I told him versus he told me. Right, so you want to get those things lined up, right? You talk to somebody, first person, right? So I'm not very good at describing these things. You can look at them more deeply. The point is, I see people being very insensitive to them, and I want to tell you why it's important. Because I thought about this. Because I'm embarrassed to bring this up. Right? And I was one of those kids who thought grammar was silly, but now I'm discovering it's really important, so I want to be able to tell you why it's important. And here's the reason. A sentence, the thing about language is discursive, which means that we only get to say one word at a time. It's a huge problem. We don't think in linear terms like that. We think in gestalts. But we can only speak in a straight line. And we can only write one word at a time. Right? This is the hardest thing about writing or speaking, is trying to squeeze something multidimensional into a single line of text. Now, in order to do that, we have to be able to assemble these lines into complex structures. Like a sentence. A sentence is a complex sequence of words. And the reason it works as a sentence is because the various words refer to each other in complex ways. Right? So I'll start with the subject of the sentence. Then I'll give it a description of the subject. Then I'll say what the subject did. Right? And this all works because the whole sentence is referring to the same subject that holds it together into a unity, right? And so every sentence has to create a complex web of references among the words that constitute it into a unity, right? And the various, and there are two different ways, in several different ways, I'm sure, but two obvious ways in which we communicate the connections among words. And one of them is word order, obviously, right? And the other one is these forms of agreement. So that if I'm reading along and it says, he, I know I can look back to the last male reference to know what I'm talking about. Right? Like that, right? And so I want you to realize that each sentence has a complex structure in which the words refer to each other, and you need to be paying attention to that. Is your sentence well-formed and well-structured, and do the words all refer to each other in unambiguous ways? Now, like I say, it's embarrassing to say this, because you should have learned this in grammar school, but most of you don't seem to know it, and so I need to say this, right? I am very interested in well-formed sentences. I know that it is impossible to think philosophically if you can't write well-structured sentences. Your ability to think and your ability to write sentences are directly correlated with each other. Somebody who can't write a good sentence can't think clearly. So I want you to start really paying attention to your grammar. Okay? Really important. And if I get a paper which I find grammatically confusing, I will immediately give it back to you to change. Because I'm not willing to read grammatically incorrect papers because it's too confusing for me. Okay? So I just want you to know that's from now on in my classes, that it's not grammatically clear, it goes back to you for revision. Okay? Now, the other thing, about papers is metaphors. I want you to learn to pay a lot of attention to your metaphors. Because, for example, I'll be reading along in some paper where people are talking about how horrible reductionistic science is. And I want to explain something. I'm going to say, now, the mechanism to explain this is so-and-so. But you don't want to do that in a paper that's attacking mechanism, right? So the point is that I want you all to wake up to the fact that metaphors have a literal meaning, and that the literal meaning is relevant when you use the metaphor. You see what I'm saying? Like, if you use the word mechanism for an explanation, you have automatically imported mechanistic ideas into your paper. So you need to think about what the words, the metaphors, what is the image that the metaphor uses, and is that image contributing to the coherency of your text? Right, so watch out for that, right? And then there's the question of logic. And this is a real question. Is the paper logical? Now, I had this experience at Esalen. I was there for a conference on panentheism, which is the whole idea, religious idea that God is the whole world and more. God's both transcendent and immanent. It doesn't matter. I had this conference, and I made the point that I was interested in seeing if we could all think together instead of thinking separately. Like, what would it mean to develop a consensus? Everybody hates it when I say that, but I tried saying it. And as part of that conversation, we came up with the realization that in order to think together, we had to align our values. Because really, one of the points I want to make is that thinking always follows our values. Our thinking always follows our values. And so we did this exercise in saying, like, what are the values that we all uphold and think are really important? So we're sitting around, there's a guy at the board, you know, and somebody raises their hand, she says, social justice. Everybody goes, yeah. Yes, what about social justice, you know? And then fairness and feminism and all of this endless reams of politically correct stuff, right? And so I raised my hand and I said, logical coherency. And the temperature of the room dropped by 10 degrees. So you see, it's hard for me to talk about this, but it's really, really, really important. There is no philosophy without logical coherency, right? It is a logical coherency that enables us to test our ideas against reality. If our ideas are not logically coherent, we can't philosophically test them. Now, there are lots of reasons to do things other than logic. Logic is not the be-all and the end-all of human life. By any means, it's a very small department of human life. I get that. It's even a small department of our knowledge activities. But it's the part of our cognitive capacity we use in philosophy. And you're not going to learn philosophy if you don't learn to be logical. Okay. So in the papers, the real challenge in writing the paper, as I said, is in putting it in a linear order. You have this complicated thought in your mind. You have all these meanings and all these associations, and you have these intuitions, and you have the desire to communicate. And it's a very complex situation you're in when you sit down to write a paper. But what you're going to write is a sequence of words. That's it. A linear sequence of words. And so the question is, how do you put the words in order so they make sense to your reader? And this is something you really have to think about. It's a technical problem that has to be kept in mind.
Can I mention something?
Yeah.
I definitely feel this tension when I write. And I wondered, though, for the purposes of this class, how much does linear logic apply to a descriptive understanding of transphysical worlds?
That is the objective of this class.
Yeah.
Top to bottom. We are here to give a logical account of the transphysical worlds.
But in what sense? It seems to me that the sense of logic can be expanded, possibly.
We have to be very clear about this.
Yeah.
But when I say logic, I mean that in the course of the argument, all the terms retain the same term retains the same meaning each time it's used. And there are no contradictions in the text.
That's impossible. That really is impossible.
Well, if you don't think you can do it, then maybe you're not a philosopher, right?
No.
Well, the fact is, yes, you're right. It is technically impossible because every time we use a word, it has a slightly different meaning depending on its context. That's true. Nonetheless, you know what I'm talking about when I say that the term should have the same meaning each time you use it. It should have the same functional meaning in your text each time it's used. And the connections you make between your terms should be consistent over and over again. If you're going to connect A and B in a certain way, you have to connect A and B that same way everywhere in the same document. Otherwise, the document is not logical. Logic is a structural feature of things, right? I'm not even claiming that reality is logical, but your paper has to be logical, because the whole point of philosophy is to play logical ideas against experience. Knowing that no logical idea will ever exhaust experience, and that any idea, if taken too seriously or pushed too far, is simply wrong, knowing that, we articulate the clearest body of ideas we can, and we test it against experience to see what we can learn about experience that way, and what we can learn about ideas that way. And that is the activity in which we will be engaged in this class. If you're interested in some other activity, which are very valid, I mean, for example, you look at Savitri, Sri Aurobindo wrote the second book of Savitri. It's the most glorious poetical expression of the transphysical worlds you'll find anywhere in the English language. And it's not logical. It's something else. I love it. It's one of my favorite texts. But in this class, we will be logical. And we are doing philosophy. Period. And if you want to get a good grade in this class, you will be logical in your paper. Period. Okay? I'm not interested in compromising about it this semester. Yeah?
I was just going to say, it seems to me that logic develops historically, and that if somebody wants to use a new type of logic in a paper, they may need to explain how they're using it, or they may not, if it's clear. And this kind of relates to this thing about fractality. Yeah. You know, things can kind of have different, which I think is kind of what you're getting at, you know.
There are many different logics, and if you want to use a different logic, just let me know and explain your logic. I have no problem with that. But you got to be clear about it. And I don't care what logic you use, as long as it's actually logical, which means that the terms retain the same meaning each time they're used, and that the connections you establish among the terms remain invariant throughout the course of the document. Right? Now, what are some criteria for a logical organization when you're writing a paper? So the first thing is, your paper has to start someplace that you're quite sure your reader is familiar with. Right, so every paper has to be written with some audience in mind. Now, I don't mean that specifically, or I don't mean that too rigidly, but I mean, for example, in your paper for this class, you either write it for me, given that you'll know a lot about what I know and don't know, or you could write it for a generally educated PCC person, or you could write it for somebody on the street. You have to make a decision which level you want to go for. But once you make that decision, you need to make sure you're providing all the necessary information for your hypothetical reader, right? So you've got to start someplace you can expect your reader to understand, and then you have to lead your reader step by step to the place you want them to go, right? And so, does the text start from a place I can expect my reader to understand? A. B. Does it lead from there in such a way that my reader has at her disposal the definitions and the thought processes she needs to make sense of the next thing I'm going to say? Right, so the paper has to unfold that way. And you have to have in mind, as you write the paper, a reader who's going through a process of discovery. Right, so you have to make sure that the next thing you say, the reader has what they need to make sense of it. That means every time in a paper you use some new term, you should define it. Now, unless the term is so common, you just think it needs no definition, unless you're writing it, let's say, for me, you know I know the definition. But in general, every word in a paper that's not common English should be defined, because even your educated reader is going to forget anyway, and everybody always likes to be reminded about the definition of a word, if it's an unfamiliar word. So you got to really pay attention to the first time you use a word in the paper. Do you have the proper definition there? Right. So you really got to think about your reader. A lot of papers I get seem completely introspective, as if the person's just writing from inside, but no sense of having a reader to whom they're trying to communicate. And And as I said, the logic is really important, because if you have a theory and you want to be able to deduce consequences from it so you can test it against experience, and you can't deduce anything from a theory unless your theory is logical. Follow me on that? Right? So in doing philosophy, logic is important. If you want to study logic more deeply, I've got a lot of sources for you. But I'm happy with just the common sense definition of logic. It's got to work. It's got to be something that a line of thought that your reader can trace and follow. Right? So that's something you got to think about in doing the papers. Okay. Now I have this idea here about the fractal nature of an elegant text. And I realized that this idea is very much in the background for me. And I'm not sure it's a perfect ideal for anybody else like me. But I just want to put it out for your contemplation. An ideal to which I find myself aspiring is that of writing a text which gives the appearance that I knew exactly where I was going from the very first word. Now, no paper ever is written like that. But you always learn a lot writing a paper. It's only on the second or third draft that you have any hope of creating the illusion that you knew from the beginning where you were going. Follow what I'm saying here? Right? But if you can write a text like that, it gives it a timeless character that's very powerful. Because it's somehow the text is removed from process and becomes this sort of self-referential jewel. It's just quite beautiful, right? All right, so to the extent that this ideal is approximated, the text becomes fractal and acquires a kind of magical timelessness. The Life Divine is an example of this particular kind of writing. Now, the point is this. It's that as I'm writing, especially in the second or third draft, I try to be aware at every moment of where I am in the unfolding of the argument. So, you know, this is chapter so-and-so. The basic theme of this chapter is this. And in this section, I'm trying to prove this. And in this paragraph, I'm saying this. But I try to keep the whole text alive in my mind. So I might say, for example, as we discussed earlier, or as we will see more deeply in the next chapter, right? And so there's this sense that the text aspires to be a kind of simultaneous whole in which all the parts refer to all the other parts seamlessly. This is an ideal that I hold for a philosophical paper. I can't impose this ideal. I'm not even sure it's a valid ideal, but I'm just sharing it with you. I noticed that it's what really moves me. All right. And so what I want to try then as an experiment this semester is I want to make do on the fifth week a five-page paper. And so on the fifth week of this class, you will be required to turn in a five-page paper, 4 to 5 pages. And this paper can do one of two things. It will either be an expository paper about some of the ideas we've discussed, just explaining it, or it will be a tentative anticipation of your term paper. Either one is fine. But I want to see this paper written with good grammar. I want to see it written logically. And I want to be able to find out what kind of work you're going to need before your final paper. That's the really thing. Right? I want to know who I need to send to a tutor, who's got good English. So I really want to work with you on it. Okay. On week 11, you will be required to turn in an outline of your term paper. Now, I will talk to you more later about how to do outlines, but that will be required. And so on week 11, what will be required will be like a 1 or 2 page outline, which includes an abstract of your paper that you intend to write, and basically the chapter and section headings with maybe a couple of words about what they'll have in them. Now, you don't have to follow this outline when you write your paper. No battle plan ever survives encounter with the enemy, and no outline ever assigns the attempt to write from it, survives the attempt to write from it. But you have to start with an outline, and then when the outline gets disrupted, you have to come back and rewrite the outline. So ultimately, you end up with an outline. And I want to make sure that by week 11, you have an outline already done. Even if it's going to change, you need to have an outline of your paper on week 11. Okay?
And then the final paper we do on the last day of class.
It says here that the first paper is due on the sixth week. Is that?
Sorry, sixth week.
Okay, just making sure.
Sixth week for the first paper. 11th week for the. Okay. So I got done earlier than I expected.
Mean we can talk about crazy stuff now?
Well, before we talk about it, I'm not really interested in talking about crazy stuff very much, but I am interested in talking about the ideas about philosophy that I brought up, and ideas that are reasonably associated with that.
So are we open for...
Yeah.
Because you used the term matter in referring that there was matter in transphysical worlds.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to, define physical matter from non-physical matter.
We're going to be doing that. It'll be one of the main themes of our semester. Okay. I don't want to try to anticipate it today. But that will be a question we'll do a lot of work on. What is the nature of transphysical matter as opposed to physical matter? And how can we understand that? So that'll be something we'll pay a lot of attention to. Any questions about philosophizing? Everybody get there?
Well, it seems to me that the terms are consistent in the idea, and what's varying is the experience of those terms. So we have these subtle variations as we experience ideas in actuality, like the context. You know, you see the same word used throughout the paper, but it's moving in experience. My mind's opening to it. I'm having a different perception of the terms, but in the ideal, it remains consistent and coherent in the ideal.
Right.
I was thinking of that distinction.
Sure, our experience of the term may change as we read the paper, but the point is the term has the same function in the argument whenever it appears. Our understanding of the argument is going to be shifting as the paper goes, as we read the paper, obviously, or write the paper. But it's very easy. What I'm talking about is common sense. We don't need to put too fine a point on it.
You mentioned the word argument. You just haven't talked as much about argument in terms of the paper, and that's... Yeah. What I tend to think about in terms of a philosophy paper, did you have any specifics that you
look
for?
What I mean by an argument is simply a sustained discursive reflection. Right? So in other words, a sustained reflection that holds the same purpose throughout and is logical. That's what I mean by an argument.
Okay.
In this context. It doesn't mean fighting with each other. It just means sort of a sustained position. Okay, no questions about that. Okay. I'm trying to think where I want to go. Any suggestions?
I have a question about the class in general.
Yeah, good.
I was wondering, things like applied kinesthetics, where you're using...
Like what?
Applied kinesthetics, where you're using the body as a measurement tool for... you know, the whole or the transphysical worlds. Do you include that in your studies of the transphysical worlds, or do you see that just as a health science to the side?
That could be a whole paper itself, right?
Yeah.
What is that about? How does that work, and so forth, right? So, I would point out that it is not scientific measurement.
Right.
It's just interesting. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I am more interested in more direct forms of perception in the transphysical worlds, but I'm sure these things work, and we can develop interesting accounts for how they work and why they work, and what would be really fun would be to see if the accounts we can generate might develop suggestions for doing that better. Stuff like that, right? That's where it becomes fun. Will our philosophical description of applied kinesiology, whatever you call it, right, help that science or not? And we'll find out. So I guess we should talk about the transphysical worlds. Get started on that. But I want to open up to discussion. Right? Let's just see where you guys are going. It might help me prepare for next week. Yeah.
You mentioned that the transphysical worlds can't be measured. Could you really go into why that is? Could you unpack that a little bit?
And... Yeah. what is measurement? And we can spend a lot of time talking about that. But let me ask you, what is measurement? What do we mean? What does it mean to measure something? What do you have to do to measure something?
To compare to an idea.
An idea, no.
Like the meter, there's an...
Oh, but the meter is not an idea. This is very important. Measurement is not comparing things to ideas.
To other actualities.
Measurement involves the comparison of actualities to each other. Clear? Now, what kind of actualities? Measurement involves a very specific kind of thing. Two very specific kinds of things are underlie all measurement. I mean, basically, I suppose I could measure the chair against a cup, but it wouldn't be very interesting, right? I want to measure the chair against a particular kind of thing, a ruler, right? Or what scientists rather suggestively call a rigid rod. That's a scientific term for it. It's a rigid rod, right? So, a ruler, right? Now, what are the properties of a ruler that make it valuable in measurement?
Consistency.
It stays the same size wherever you move it. Now, snakes don't do that, right? Neither do tomatoes. You don't use them for measurement. You don't use rubber bands for measurement. Why not? They don't have the proper kind of properties, right? A measuring ruler has to be a rigid, inorganic, stable system that does not change its relevant properties over time, right? Think about a rubber ruler has to be, right? And a clock. What is a clock? What's the characteristic of a clock? It's a periodic oscillator. It's something that oscillates with a constant frequency. That's what a clock is, right? So unless you have rulers and clocks, you don't have measurement. That's the first thing. Just think about that. All this complicated science. Incredible amounts of complex measurement involving huge teams and indirect measurements and God knows what. It all comes down to rulers and clocks. At the end, you've got a meter or a dial or something that's either a ruler or a clock. That's what measurement is about. It's comparing things to rulers and clocks.
Time and space.
You mentioned that transphysical worlds have their own space and time.
Would
they have their own measurements that we just couldn't measure?
Hold on, it's a good question. So measurement consists of comparing things to rulers and clocks. Now, there's one more condition you need for measurement. Let's say I'm going to measure this chair, and it's going to be 12, 14 inches across, right? And I want to see if I can get the chair through the door over there. So I go over there and I measure the door. And the door is 16 inches. I can get the chair through, right? But if this were a dream, it wouldn't work. Because if this were a dream, I could measure this thing over here and measure that over there, and I could drag this across the room and be twice as big as the door. Right? Because sizes don't hold constant in dreams. Right? So the only way sizes hold constant is if we can imagine the entire world as being pervaded by parallel lines. Right, so there's got to be some system of parallel lines between here and the door such that 14 inches over here means the same thing as 14 inches over there. Right, space has to have a certain structure if measurement is going to be possible. Right? And space, the property space has to have is that it has to be, the technical thing is it has to have zero curvature. But the basic point is that it has to be able to be such that you can imagine it is pervaded by parallel lines. Not all geometrical spaces can be characterized by parallel lines. Only some geometries have parallel lines. There are other geometries in which there are no parallel lines, or in which there are an infinite number of parallel lines through a given point outside of a given line, or in which all parallel lines meet twice. Right? So all these different geometries. Only in those geometries where there are parallel lines is measurement possible. I'm not saying this geometrically very well. You get the point, I hope, right? That there are a lot of different geometries, and only in those geometries that have parallel lines is measurement possible. Yes?
So when I hear the word geometry, I think of an organized system of organizing space and time
that
allows you to do things like measure. but you're talking about other geometry, so they're still geometry. So don't they also have a certain system of logical...
They do, but they don't necessarily permit measurement in them.
They wouldn't just be some kind of an extended or different kind of measurement?
No. Measurement is our ability to unambiguously assign numbers, in this case, to distance. So the only way you can unambiguously assign number to distance is if there's a fixed unit of measure. And the fixed unit of measure only is important if there are parallel lines, so the fixed unit of measure means the same thing everywhere you move it. There are geometries in which that doesn't happen, in which there are no parallel lines, for example. And so you can't measure because there's no unit of measure.
But those geometries, I mean, if you're talking about like, you know, Riemannian geometry, you know, there's the two other main ones where you redefine parallel to mean either that a line crosses another line only once, or that a line crosses many lines. I'm not saying this well, but you know, those are sort of the two main non-Euclidean geometries. There's a thing that's not holding together here because those are used by physicists.
Okay.
So how can that be non-scientific or non-measurement or...
Okay, I'm sorry. I was intending to do this later in the semester. Do you want to do it now? We can do some geometry. Can we do some geometry?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do some geometry. Euclidean geometry. We all know about that. We all learned it in high school. Newtonian geometry, Euclidean geometry, right? And Euclidean geometry is defined by a number of axioms, but the one that's interesting to us is this, is that through a given line and given a single point, there's one and only one parallel line that goes through that point. Then we have Riemannian geometry, and in Riemannian geometry, you have a line, you have a point outside of it, and all parallel lines cross at two places in Riemannian geometry. The only way to understand this is to think of it as the geometry of the surface of the sphere, in which the great circles are all parallel and they all cross twice. Yeah.
How do you spell what you're referring to?
R-E-I-N-E-N-N-I-A-N.
R-I-E.
R-I-E, you got it.
M-A-N-N. R-I-E-M-A-N-N-I-A-N. It's normally pronounced Riemannian.
Thank you.
So.
Thank you. I always like it when you guys correct me. Always feel free. Okay, then the other one is called Lobachevskian. You know how to spell that?
L-O-B-A. L-O-B-A-C-H-E-V-S-K-Y-A-N or I-A-N, I don't know.
Yeah, and anyway, I can't draw. It's a saddleback. And the point is that given a parallel line and a point outside of it, there's an infinite number of parallel lines. Now, it turns out that there's two different sets of parallels, right? Now, it turns out that we cannot actually tell the nature of the geometry of the space that we live in. It could be any one of these. And there's no way to tell empirically. So these are all scientific and they all work. Right? But there's also something else called the curvature of the space. And the curvature of the space is really mysterious, but you can imagine it. I'm going to give you a way to imagine it. It's not actually the proper geometrical definition, which is much more subtle. But you can imagine it like this. You have a plane, and the plane is flat, right? But the plane is sitting in a larger three-dimensional space, right? And so suppose you bent the plane, like it was a sheet of metal, and you bent it, right? It would now have curvature in a higher dimension. So if you were like a being that just lived inside the sheet of metal, you wouldn't even know it was bent because it's bent through a higher dimension. Now the problem is that if it's bent in a lumpy kind of way, let's say it's got a bunch of protuberances on it, you're going to have a problem because you're not going to be able to move objects through it. There's this thing called free mobility. Let's just say you have a plane, a Euclidean plane, you have a line on it. You can move that line anywhere on the plane. Doesn't matter. It's freely mobile anywhere you want to put it. Right? But suppose that unbeknownst to you, the plane had bumps in it in a higher dimension. Right? And so you're trying to move your figure through the plane
and it hits one of those bumps and it can't move. It's no longer freely mobile because the plane is somehow bumpy, right? So you can't tell from inside the plane that it's bumpy, but if you're outside, you'd see it was bumpy. And it means that these geometrical figures don't have free mobility. And it means, in effect, that the distance between different points is distorted by this distortion in the space, by the curvature in the space. It's a very hard concept to get, right? But it's used in relativity theory, because according to Einstein, gravitation is a distortion, a curvature of space-time. Right, so that if you pictured space like a plane, there would be these funnels around the stars. The whole space would be distorted in this higher dimension. Now, here's the problem that Einstein didn't realize, didn't think about, is that if your space is distorted, if the curvature is uneven or lumpy, then there are no parallel lines, and measurement is undefined, and you can't do cosmological physics. So Einstein's definition of relativity makes it impossible to know how big the universe is or anything like that, because you can't measure over long distances if general relativity is correct, because it makes the curvature of space-time uneven. Whitehead had tried to reformulate relativity from the ground up in order to keep space flat so measurement was possible, and instead of making gravity a curvature of space-time, he made it into a force like it used to be, because that way you could still have measurement possible. Okay, the point is that measurement is possible in any one of these geometries as long as it has a flat curvature or a curvature of zero or any constant curvature. But if the curvature is uneven or lumpy, then you can't do measurement. Okay. Now, that's the whole curvature thing. That's why I had to go through the curvature thing, because all these geometries will permit measurement as long as the curvature of space is constant. Constant value everywhere. Now, these three forms of geometry, all of which are valid in describing the physical world, are all parts of another type of geometry called projective geometry. Now, projective geometry is a geometry that works with points and lines, but it never defines parallels. See, all of these geometries have parallel lines defined, and there are three different definitions of parallels that give you three different geometries. But in projective geometry, parallel lines aren't even defined. There's no such thing as a parallel line in projective geometry. You derive the other geometries from projective geometry by introducing a parallel postulate into them. So it's a more general form of geometry. See what I'm saying? And then projective geometry is part of something even more general, which is called topology. Topology defines the relationships among regions of space, but it never defines either points or lines. It just deals with regions. Right? And so there's a hierarchy of geometries. And as we get higher into this hierarchy of geometries, the number of assumptions is smaller. Right? As we move down in the hierarchy, we add more and more rigid rules governing movement. So there's this hierarchy of geometries from the very flexible to the very rigid. Only in the most rigid and the most highly defined geometries is measurement possible. All of our science is based on measurement, which means it only applies to those of our experiences that can be organized by a metrical geometry. And the only ones of our experiences that can be organized by a metrical geometry are those that come from our meat senses, our physical senses, and primarily from the focal point of the visual and tactile senses. Those are the perceptions that we can organize scientifically in terms of a metrical space-time. Those are the ones to which measurement apply. But dreams, there's no rulers in dreams because nothing stands still. There's nothing that's not alive in the dream. Everything in the transphysical world, in the subtle world, everything in the astral world or the vital world is alive and respirating and breathing and changing and adapting to the environment. And so there's nothing as stupid as a ruler or a clock existing in the astral world. And so how can you possibly measure anything? Because there's no rulers and no clocks. On top of which, there are no parallel lines in the space there, right? So if you haven't got rulers, and you haven't got clocks, and you haven't got parallel lines, how are you going to perform measurements in transphysical worlds?
Just stick to the physical world for a second. Is what you're saying that, for example, when cosmologists or astrophysicists say that the star Betelgeuse is 7 light-years away, are you saying that that's not actually an accurate measurement?
Well, of course. You see, if Einstein is correct, we can't even make that measurement. You see, the reason we can talk about how old the universe is or how many light-years apart stars are away from each other is because we assume that very small differences in our measuring instruments can be extrapolated to very large distances on the cosmic scale, which means that there has to be a set of parallel lines between this little experiment and the cosmos that keeps all the relationships the same as we expand them.
Right.
If space is not evenly curved, if the curvature of space-time is distorted by gravity, then there's no reason to suppose that there's a one-to-one correlation between changes in distances in our measuring instruments and changes in distance out in the sky.
So is this a uniform problem?
It's a big problem. This is a uniform problem. It's one of these amazing things you find when you start doing philosophy of science.
Astrophysicists know about things like gravitational lenses, for example, when they see light bending around.
But they simply don't consider this problem, as far as I can tell. Whitehead saw that in an unevenly curved space, astrophysics is impossible. And so he redesigned relativity theory to make astrophysics possible. Astrophysicists just ignore the fact that it's impossible and do it anyway.
But it works with relatively smaller distances? Because we can still
It depends on the curvature of the space. If the space is flat enough locally, you can do it. But you can't necessarily extrapolate over long distances if the space is curved, because distances don't correspond over long distances. You know, the parallels aren't there. Bill?
I'm a little confused by the by limiting the concept of measurement to time and distance. For example, there is pressure.
But the point is that
the distance on a clock dial.
That's the point. It comes down to the distance on a dial. That's your ruler.
Yeah, as a sensory experience about things.
Yeah, so measurement comes down to rulers and clocks. Finally, now some experimenter looks at some ruler or some clock and gets a number at the end of the measurement.
You have to think about that. There are a lot of possibilities. I don't get that's fully true.
I will talk about
it's
it.
Fully general.
And there's a slightly different meaning of the term measurement in quantum mechanics, which is different. I'm talking about the classical definition of measurement.
Okay.
So
measurement only works if the space is not curved. And we can't
If it's evenly curved, yeah.
If it's evenly curved.
Yeah.
Okay, but we can't tell that unless we're looking from a higher dimension.
Is that right? The mathematics of it are subtle. Bill might know better than I do. There's apparently some way to talk about curvature without talking about higher dimensions, and it has to do with something about distance between points. And I understood it once, and I've completely forgotten it now. But you have to look up into it more.
I mean, there's a million metrics in all kinds of complex mathematical spaces. I'm not sure they're analogous exactly.
They're not. That's what I'm saying.
Measurement.
Measurement is assigning a number to something, and you do it by comparing it to a ruler or a clock. Yeah.
So I'm thinking that, are we saying maybe that a geometric space could be logically coherent but not consistent in its space and time?
I don't know what you mean by consistent.
Well, consistent that this space and time here is the same as it is over there, the parallel.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking like any logically coherent system implies measurement. So that's not true.
That is not true.
So we could have
geometry is completely logical, and measurement is not possible in projective geometry.
Okay. So, and that which is part of this class is saying there can be logical coherence in the transphysical worlds without being a consistency in points in those worlds.
Without being able to do measurement.
Without being able to do measurement.
Right. That's the point. Right. See, in the modern world, we've come to think that what's objective is what we can measure. If that's true, there are no transphysical worlds, because measurement is not possible in the transphysical worlds. But those are actual worlds that we can experience. They have all the criteria of objectivity. We just can't measure. And that's why later on as we go on, we'll talk about the criteria of objectivity and so forth.
And then we would say a transphysical world that wasn't logically coherent isn't real, or?
I don't think that, I would want to say that actuality is always logically coherent. Right? That's one of the amazing things about actuality, right? We have possibility, and then we have actuality. What's the difference between what's possible and what's actual? Part of what it means to be actual is to be logically consistent with the past having been the way it was. Right?
Because the modern scientific mind is, when they're saying the transphysical worlds are, they're saying, well, that's just imagination. They're saying that it's not logically coherent. It's not rational, or it's not real. Because I can't measure it, it's not real.
The reason they're saying it's not real is very complex, and we're going to talk about it in 2 weeks. We're going to talk about the whole history of science and why they came to this conclusion and so forth. But the point I'm making is that objectivity and the ability to be measured are not the same thing. There can be worlds that are real worlds in which separate individuals are causally interacting with one another in an environment, but in which measurement is not possible. This is a new idea, right? This is a very important idea I'm trying to introduce to you. To think objectivity without numbers. And we'll find ways to do that as we go on. What do you think about this?
Cool.
Yeah, man.
How do you conceive of the relationship between transphysical worlds and the physical? Like, do we, when we're measuring or attempting to measure the physical space-time continuum, are we coming into contact with or being influenced by effects of the transphysical? Like, there's an interpretation.
Well, one of the things I'm going to be teaching is that we have tended to confuse the physical world and the waking world. And they're not at all the same thing. Right? So the physical world is the world defined by physics. And it's a world of essentially inorganic entities which can be more or less successfully predicted on the basis of necessity and chance. Right? They're very simple entities. And so if we were actually to see the physical world, we wouldn't be seeing people or tables or chairs or anything. We'd just be seeing energy patterns or dances of molecules or something like that. That's what the physical world is, right? And for an atom, that's all it sees, is other atoms, right? But we live in the waking world, which is not the physical world, because the waking world is populated by living beings and thinking beings. Right? And because most of what happens in the waking world is largely controlled by the thinking and living beings who live in it. They're the predominant factors in our everyday life. And they're not in the physical world. I would say that my personality, my being, the part of me that's going to survive my physical death is certainly not in the physical world. It's already in a transphysical world. And so I would say that human beings consist of, we're awake, we're a physical body, and then we have an astral body, a dream body, that's focusing its attention through the physical body, and a mental body that's focusing attention through the vital body, through the physical body. Right? So that we have these different bodies, at least three, and at least two of those are transphysical, and that right now at this moment, you are a being that lives in the transphysical worlds already. And what you're doing is, what you're seeing is not the physical world. It's the complex of the physical world and the astral world and the mental world all creating this appearance, which we are experiencing as astral and mental disembodied beings, right? The picture that we have of the physical world could never be generated by a purely physical being. We're already transphysical. And the world, the waking world, is already fully pervaded by the transphysical worlds. But those worlds not only exist as dimensions of the waking world, but they also exist on their own outside of the waking world.
See what I'm saying?
But there's, yeah, it's, like I said, what comes to mind to me is why then the physical world? Because it seems like the laws and the causality that governs this world is so much more restricting than...
That's right. That's right. So that becomes a really, really crucial question. And it's not a question that we'll discuss much in this class. But the answer to it that I find most satisfying is Sri Aurobindo's answer, which defines the physical world as the condition for the evolution. And it defines the establishing of those difficult initial conditions of evolution as an adventure of consciousness. So there's a whole scheme we could talk about there, right? That's one possible answer to your question. Your question's a very important one. Yeah?
So when we talk about the concrete versus the abstract,
yeah.
Which of these worlds, or all of them, which is great. The concrete?
All of them. This is a great question. Right? So we make a distinction between the concrete and the abstract, where the abstract is the idea. Abstractions are ideas, characteristics, forms, patterns. Right? And the concrete is actuality. Right? So right now, you are an actual being. The actual is your totality of your experience is an actual experience. Then out of that, you can abstract a lot of things. You can abstract people, you can abstract chairs, you can abstract the physical world, you can abstract the astral world. Those are all parts of your experience, but your experience is the concrete. So the abstract is just the idea of the pattern. The concrete is the actual experience, the real thing, the full actual thing is concrete. Right? Now, the concrete, the actual reality, I will suggest, this would be pretty, I think, go down pretty easy, consists of events. Like quantum mechanics says, what's real are happenings, right? Apparently solid things are just lots and lots of subatomic events happening in some kind of order that makes them look steady, but really it's all happening. Event, event, event. That's the nature of reality. And in each event, there's the concrete event, the actual experience that forms of that event, and there are the various ideas or characteristics that go into it, the concrete and the abstract. That's true in every world. So in the physical world, we have events of a very simple kind, inorganic events, and the abstractions that characterize them are more or less the abstractions of physics. And then we have higher grade, more complex events. These are like the events of living beings. And there are different characteristics that characterize, different abstractions apply to those events. And then we have these very high, complex events, like human events, and there's a whole set of abstractions that apply to them. So we have the concrete and the abstract on all levels of the worlds. Right? So it's like this. We have the physical world, the vital world, and the mental world. These are these three worlds. And in every world, we have the concrete and the abstract. That goes all the way up the hierarchy. See? This is a great question, Linda, because it's really important to get this straight. There's two different distinctions. The abstract is not the transphysical. The transphysical worlds are actual concrete worlds that are not as simple or rigid as the physical world is. It would take a whole semester to put this across, so I'm just starting, right?
How does activity in each world affect each other?
That's a complex question. There are causal relations within each world. For example, physics generally concerns the way one inorganic occasion affects another one. And there are also then living beings affecting each other psychically and mental beings affecting each other telepathically. And then there are ways in which mental beings affect astral beings and ways in which astral beings affect physical beings. And of course, it goes back this way as well. So you have a very complex array of causes that we'll be analyzing as we go through the semester. In fact, we'll have a whole new analysis of causality that will help us to disentangle these different types of causal reactions among the different transphysical worlds.
Well, you know, I know it's going to take a while to go through all that over the semester, but in the meantime, how might you encourage, you know, our optimal consciousness?
Good question. That's a very good question. Well, I would urge you to notice in your own language, in your own thinking, every time you assume that the physical world is what's real. Watch that assumption. It's not correct, and this semester we want to change it. So watch when you make that assumption. We want to break the habit of associating the physical and the actual. They're not the same thing. What else? Notice your dreams. Try hard to remember your dreams. And when you look at your dreams, the usual way to look at them is in terms of their meaning. And instead of looking at that way, I want to give you a new way to look at dreams. I want you to look at dreams logically. Like, for example, what are the entities in your dreams? What's the space like in your dreams? What is it like in your dream to move from one place to another? How do the scenes change? Right? I want you to start looking at your dreams as if you're a physicist of the astral world, not as if you're a psychologist of the astral world wondering how the complexes interact with the meaning of your life, but like you're just looking at it as a scene. How did that get there? How did that move from there to there? How do I move from here to here? Right? Start looking at your dreams as if you're looking at a waking life and try to start deducing the rules of movement and the rules of which by which things occur in dreams the way you do in waking life. Right? So take a different attitude toward your dreams. Notice when in waking life you begin to get inputs from your transphysical senses. Now, for example, this is what Natalie does all the time, right? Natalie is working to integrate data from her transphysical senses into her interactions with people in the waking world, right? But what kind of transphysical perceptions are you having, right? You might notice, for example, that you see pictures. Some people see pictures. A lot of psychics see pictures. You ask them a question, they see a picture, and then they try to translate that for you. Sometimes people have feelings. Most of my psychic input comes kinesthetically. So that's, I'm clairsentient rather than clairvoyant. I get complex feelings in my body when I'm talking to people, which I can translate into meanings in the same way other people can translate psychic images into meanings. Right? So look at the ways that you get information about the world that are not coming directly through your senses. Start studying those things. Pay attention to those. Those are some ways to approach your life as we're doing this class. Good? Yeah.
Just a quick question. These three astral bodies, or three different bodies that you're describing, does that just pertain to humans?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Living? Just
everything. Everything. Actually. Well, it's tricky. Let me say this. In general, every event has certain living properties and certain thinking properties. We'll discuss that. But in general, the inorganic events have very little feeling and very little thinking. Mm-hmm. Your question again?
Well, it's the three different...
Right.
And so yeah, I'm wondering if it's just humans or animals.
So basically the idea would be this. The physical world consists of a whole bunch of inorganic entities interacting with each other. The astral world consists of a whole bunch of dream bodies interacting with each other. Some, but not all of those dream bodies also are associated with physical bodies. Many of them are not. And then there's another world above that, the mental world, which consists of mental beings telepathically interacting with each other in a world all their own. Some of them have astral bodies, right? Some of them don't. And so forth, right? Like that. So the worlds get bigger as you go up.
Yeah. But do the things that are in the physical world all have representations or analogs or presences in the higher worlds?
Probably not.
So there's...
I mean, it's a little tricky.
It's like a Venn diagram. There are places where they all may overlap, but they don't... All of...
That's right. It's sort of like this. It's like, if this was the physical world, then let's say... Let's say this would be the astral world, right? So this would be the part of the physical world that's totally non-living, and this would be the biological part of the physical world, right? And did I do this right? Then we have a thinking world, something like that.
I'm not sure. You get the basic
idea. Okay, but they don't all overlap.
They don't all overlap. Yeah. Right? Not strictly. Unless, I mean, it's a little tricky, but basically they don't overlap.
Astral equals vital?
Yeah, I use those words as synonyms. Astral comes from the theosophical tradition, and vital is the word Sri Aurobindo uses. And they both work, and I just kind of use them interchangeably.
So you're implying that some human beings don't have a spiritual...
No, all human beings have astral bodies, but not all astral beings have physical bodies.
Okay, so in your diagram, what's like...
Every living being has an astral body. Every thinking being has a mental body. But not all mental bodies have either feeling bodies or physical bodies. You can be a disincarnate mental body.
Right. No, I get that part. But if the first sphere, the smallest one, is Earth...
No, it's just... I meant the physical universe.
It's things
the
like
Earth
rocks.
The physical universe. Let's see if I can do this better.
Like a rock.
Well, here's the physical universe, right? I said, that minds... Yeah, I think this will work. And if I do that, then this is, these are biological organisms, and these are inorganic organisms.
Okay, so like I'm just saying things like rocks and minerals.
That'd be down here. And then living beings would be up here. Right? But there are a lot of living beings that don't have physical bodies.
Yeah, no, I get that part, but I'm just trying to envision physical entities that you're implying may not have a spiritual equivalent, which is...
Well, like a rock, maybe.
Yeah, which doesn't fit with...
Well, you know, it doesn't fit with mine either.
I didn't think it did, that's why I...
The point is, this is a complicated question. Every entity, I will claim, every actual entity involves being causally affected and feeling and interpreting and deciding. Nothing becomes real if it doesn't go through all those three processes. And we'll develop this as we go on, okay? And so in a certain sense, the feeling part is sort of like the astral part, and the deciding part is sort of like the mental part, right? And so in a certain way, every entity contains all the principles. But then we have the inorganic world, the world studied by physicists, in which the vital principle and the mental principle are basically completely suppressed. And we get these inorganic occasions in which the life and the mind are practically dormant. And they form a physical world. And then we get these astral beings who are much more awake than the physical beings are. They're like living beings. And some of those living beings become the personalities of cells and other living beings, and some of them don't. And so forth, right? So we have these worlds. It's like the three principles are habit, life, and mind, or something like that, right? And every entity has all three of those. But the physical world, per se, is dominated by habit. The vital world is dominated by feeling. The mental world is dominated by thought. And then we have these three worlds, each of which has all three characters, but in different proportions, and then have the way the world gets mixed up. We'll develop all this, but it's too much to say in one day. So we're sort of doing an anticipation of what we're going to be studying, right? Getting a sense of the territory and the problems that we'll be dealing with. But we're going to develop a consistent, clear conceptual apparatus for answering all these questions that will make sense by the end of the course. That's it.
Can I ask one last question about that?
Yeah.
So it also, your diagram implies that mental activity is superior to feeling and physicality, or no?
In some sense, I will generally hold the position that cognitive activity is more evolved than imaginal activity, which is more evolved than habitual activity. I am aware there are questions about that, but I think there's a good reason for it. I'm not going to claim it's the ultimate way to see things, but it's going to be the way that I'm going to, angle from which I'm going to be operating a lot of the time in this class. I know there are problems with it, and we can talk about them, but that's how I'm generally looking at it. And you'll see, I think, that it'll make at least some sense in the context I'm developing. But I accept your reservations about it, and I'm willing to listen to them at the right time. Yeah.
So then that makes me wonder whether each of these worlds is a correlate to the predominant mode of thinking in some of Gebser's mutations.
It is, but in a way that would really surprise you. A lot of you won't know what I'm talking about here. I just want to say it really quick so Richard can think about it. The magical world
is polarized at the mental level.
Okay.
The mythic at the vital, and the mental at the physical, right? So it's a reverse thing. We tend to, right? So the highest mentality happens in the magical times. And then we descend to the lower bodies as we move up through the mutations.
And that relates to, throw another thinker in, that relates to involution of, as described by Sri Aurobindo.
Yes.
Okay.
You can all ignore that.
What will the integral look like then?
I don't understand your question, how it comes out of it.
Well, in other words,
the integral involves all three. It's the synthesis of all three. They all become transparent to each other in some higher synthesis, which has to do with the basic origin of things. There's transparency with pure consciousness, with enlightenment in some way.
And part of my reason for mentioning Aurobindo by name was to try to give another plug for the study group.
Okay.
So people who want to like start talking about who the hell are these people and what are they talking about, you know, come next Thursday. And we'll keep, whenever you do come, we'll keep answering questions wherever they come from. And the people who have been there for a while will kind of sit back and let you bring your new questions in. So it's never too late in the semester to start coming. But the sooner you come, the more juice, you know, that we'll really kind of be able to get into it. So that's the end of my plug.
Excellent. Thank you for the plug. I want you to plug it. I want people to go. I think it's great help.
But you don't have a room yet, right?
I don't yet, but I will send an email to everybody in the class. So anybody who's like auditing, who's not on the class list, if you want to come, just give me your email address, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of the information too.
Okay.
So it's open to everybody. So.
Do you have email addresses now?
Well, there's a way of going into Pathfinder or whatever, MyCIIS. You go to the course, and then you can get the email address. You can send an email to everybody in the class, and you can show the emails or not show the emails. So if you want to get an email list that you can then use, you can do that.
Right.
But in terms of people who are just auditing, you know, just come up to me and give me your email address, and I'll try to make sure that I make, you know, let you know as well.
Okay, so I'm thinking, you know, this is the first day of the semester. I very rarely run out of material in a class, but I didn't calculate right today. And I'm thinking of ending a little early unless somebody has another question you want to ask. Okay, so I feel we really did cover the thing about philosophizing and about your papers. It's really important. If you have more questions about that, at any point, raise them in class. We did a nice job of sort of opening up some of the topics we're going to be discussing this semester, and next time we'll get to work more systematically. Okay? Thank you all. Welcome. See you next week.